Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. Today we're joined by Victor Veith. Victor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
Now we appreciate it. Victor is the Director of Education and Research with the Zero Abuse Project. And the name of the organization kind of is a hint at what we'll be talking about today. There are many dangers of the COVID-19 pandemic. It seems the list continues to grow, and today we're going to talk about one that you may not have heard the CDC discuss, and that is child abuse. Many child protection professionals believe child abuse is likely to increase during the pandemic because most abusers are parents or siblings who now have more complete access to the child victim. In turn, the victim may no longer have school teachers, faith leaders, or other mandated reporters they can access for help or who may detect a sign of abuse. Children may also have reduced access to medical and mental health providers. And this is according to a report that you recently contributed to, Victor, called Responding to Child Abuse During a Pandemic, 25 Tips for Multidisciplinary Teams. And while we encourage you, our listeners, to read the full 25 tips in the report, we're not going to cover all 25 in today's discussion, but we are going to get into a lot of tips and also just other insights that Victor can give to us as we try and make sure that this doesn't get lost in all of the other COVID challenges that all of us are addressing. So, Victor, let's talk about identifying abuse during a pandemic. We now have limited interactions with children outside of our own homes. So where and what should we be looking for in a time of social distancing and virtual interactions?
We have limited interactions, but we still have some interactions with children. So although schools now are closing down for the summer, there's still maybe some summer classes or ongoing tutoring, or faith leaders or coaches or others still may be intersecting with children via Zoom or another platform. So there are some common sense things we could look up for in terms of physical abuse. A handprint on the face is usually two or three linear lines. Another telltale sign of physical abuse is a pockmark, a little blood mark inside and behind the ear, because a offender grabs the child's ear and pulls them across the room, or you grab the child's hair and a pocket of hair literally comes out. Marks around the neck could indicate strangulation. If you are, say, a grocer or someone else who may intersect with a family who comes to your facility, the old adage among pediatricians is if a child can't cruise, they can't bruise. So if you've got a four-month-old or a young child who can't really crawl, can't really move, and they've got injuries you may pick up on as they come through, say, a grocery line, that would be indicative of abuse. If you're engaged with a family for any number of reasons via Zoom or another platform, or they're just your next door neighbor and you hear excessive yelling, that may be an indicator of stress. I would also say, just generally for those who are out there, paying attention on your social media and other platforms as you intersect with your friends and extended family and others on your network. Are there indicators of stress showing up there? Are people talking about how hard it is to have the children home from school and to manage their homeschooling while you're still trying to work and now you don't have traditional outlets and things like that? We can all be a support network for one another and reaching out to folks and asking how they're doing and offering support. Oftentimes it's the little things that may be very significant, very helpful in preventing abuse.
Thank you. And how can we encourage children to look out for each other during this time?
A couple of things. One, we always need to remember that the primary burden of protecting children should not be on the children themselves, but on we as adults. So we should start out by saying, what are we as adults going to do to protect the children in our network? And one of those things may be healthy conversations with our children about personal safety. What do you do if you're online and somebody is saying or suggesting or asking you to send a picture of yourself? What would you do in those scenarios? And always reminding children that the primary folks that are going to protect them are adults, and to let them know that they can always come to us and share concerns or worries of whatever may be happening in their world. There are things we can do to teach children personal safety. On the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center, which is one of our programs, you can find it online. There's a series of what if games that parents can play with their children. What if this happened? You know, you were walking down the street and somebody said, oh, my cat is stuck in a tree. Can you, little boy or girl, help me get it out? What do you do? Oh, well, that's not one of my safety rules. I need to check first with an adult and get an adult engaged. Things like that we can find online that we can work through with our children. I would also say that we as adults have a moral responsibility to build resiliency in our children. We are living through a pandemic. We are struggling with so many other social ills these days. What can we do to build resiliency in our children? Dr. Michelle Madsen-Thompson is one of our nation's foremost experts on resiliency. She has designed a series of one-page documents that parents can go through with little children about managing stress during a time of quarantine, and they're not able to access their regular friends and their regular activities. You can find those on multiple sites online. APSAC, the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children, if you go to their website, APSAC.org, under the COVID-19 section, you'll actually find a box with resiliency resources, things that parents can go through with their children. The World Health Organization also has resources for parents to manage their own stress and also to manage the stressors of children during these difficult times. There's a lot that parents can do, and there's so much quality information out there if we take the time to look for it. I'll mention one additional resource for parents. SHIELD, which is a child abuse task force in West Virginia, has designed a series of free, relatively small videos that parents can go through with their children about keeping themselves safe during the pandemic and during non-pandemic times as well. And it can help create a healthy conversation between adults and children about child protection matters. So that's another free resource you can find online that can be very helpful to parents and the children that are entrusted to us.
Excellent. Thank you so much for all of those resources. We really appreciate you sharing those. In addition to, you know, just answering the question and providing insights, of course, it's always great to have tools and resources to go to follow up. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, in a pandemic, everyone is concerned about exposure. So please provide some guidance on how CPS, social workers, and even attorneys can investigate and support child victims during a pandemic.
I think one of the things happening in the pandemic is we've expanded our pool of who is a mandated reporter. In 17 states, every adult is a mandated reporter. 33 states, it's the traditional teachers and doctors and faith leaders and the like who are expected to look out for and report suspicious signs of abuse. But a lot of the traditional mandated reporters are no longer intersecting with children. So we do have to make contact with, say, grocers and educate them as to what is or is not suspicious of abuse. And if you see a suspicion, where can you turn to for someone who may help you? Faith leaders, for the most part, are mandated reporters, but they often don't report for a variety of reasons. We can educate them as well. A lot of families who are stressed are turning to faith leaders up first, so engaging them could be very helpful. In terms of how multidisciplinary teams, child protection workers, criminal justice professionals, and others are responding to abuse or concerns of abuse during the pandemic, investigations are in fact changing. So traditionally, a child abuse investigation begins with a forensic interview, typically in an accredited children's advocacy center. And those children's advocacy centers are changing how we speak with children. In some cases, we are doing teleforensic interviews where a child may still come to the facility, but they're in one room and the interviewer is in another room. Or perhaps the child is in a law enforcement or CPS agency and they're put in a soft room, soft meaning they're comfortable, child-friendly chairs and flip charts and other materials. And the forensic interviewer is in their home or perhaps in the CAC, and they dialogue with one another. In really urgent emergency cases, the child might receive a teleforensic interview while they're located in their own home under certain precautions and the interviewer is elsewhere. That might happen if, for example, a child or someone in their family is diagnosed with COVID-19 and can't be safely moved to another facility. Most interviews are still taking place inside children's advocacy centers, but with precautions taken. There are health screenings going on for the children and their families who may come into the facility. We are limiting the number of personnel inside a facility. There's personal protective equipment on the interviewer and typically the child, with some exceptions. Some children who are very young, they just fidget, they struggle with the mask, they take it off, they throw it away, they won't keep it on. So in some instances, they're being interviewed without the mask, but perhaps the interviewer is wearing a PPE and there's some social distancing. A child who's a victim of torture, who had been gagged and confined, they may struggle with the mask because it's a trigger of the trauma. So there are some exceptions where PPE might not be employed, but for the most part, the interviews are happening inside a children's advocacy center with PPE and other adjustments being made. That's not perfect. There are limitations. Children communicate not only with their words, but their facial expressions. And those expressions may help us understand, are they being angry or sad or conveying some other emotion? Some of that becomes more difficult with part of their face covered. But those adjustments are being made because of the times that we live in. Investigations are changing as well. Officers may be more cautious entering a home without proper screening or without adequate personal protective equipment. CPS is either pulling back or changing child safety checks. We have some concerns about that because if you needed child safety checks before the pandemic, perhaps we need them even more after the pandemic with increased stress and other factors that may be contributing to abuse. But we certainly have to do those checks safely. And that may involve a parent in the home walking around with their laptop or their phone so you can see, is there adequate food or whatever other concerns that were leading to safety checks in the past. So adjustments like that are being made and we're changing on a regular basis as new and better information comes down as we think creatively how to still protect children during the pandemic, protect them from abuse, but also keep everyone as safe as possible from a potentially deadly virus.
Yeah, it's certainly challenging. So let's talk about evidence collection specifically. How is evidence collection being impacted by the pandemic?
Some of that we talked about with forensic interviews, which is the primary source of evidence in at least sexual abuse cases, the words of the child. So that's being changed. We're still audio and video recording, but it may now be by teleforensic interviewing or with adjustments in the interview room. But other things are being impacted as well. So you are executing a search warrant in a case of child physical abuse, and you're accessing information about blood spatter, semen, or other fluids or other evidence. You're collecting it even more cautiously than you have in the past. You're taking your own personal protective equipment to as high a level as possible. We also see in some jurisdiction there's a delay in processing evidence because there's sort of a triage system, and so some cases may be processed a little more slowly than they have in the past. And there may be more reluctance than there has been in the past about going into homes and searching for evidence. We, at the Zero Abuse Project, doing everything we can to push back on that mentality. We argue that child abuse investigations, child abuse prosecutions, child abuse assessments are essential functions that must continue even during this pandemic. But we do have to make adjustments to make the assessments and the investigations as safe as possible.
You mentioned some virtualization already, but are there other virtualization of systems due to the recent stay-at-home orders?
Yes, absolutely. We are hearing across the country that most children's advocacy centers are moving therapy services to a virtual platform. So telemental health is clearly increasing. And the feedback I'm getting from the front lines is that's a reform we may want to continue long-term because it is helpful to families who may struggle with transportation to the Children's Advocacy Center, or they're in a rural or isolated community where it's harder to get to a facility. So the feedback I'm getting is the telemental health is actually working really well, and we may want to continue it because we're able to do more sessions and service more children and their families than we have in the past. Although even with that, there are challenges. You may not have a safe spot in a particular child's home where confidentiality can be protected. So there are things to work through, but that seems to be a major adjustment and perhaps a reform that continues long-term. Case review meetings where periodically the multidisciplinary team gets together and reviews all the child protection cases and addresses the needs of various families. Those meetings are continuing, but instead of in-person, they are largely online. And training of child protection professionals has moved from conferences and other in-person forums to a virtual world. We train, that's a primary obligation of our center. We train about 30,000 professionals a year, but since the pandemic, every conference so far has moved to a virtual platform. And it too may be a reform we continue long term. A lot of people have always been reluctant to be trained online. They think they lose quite a bit, and perhaps we do lose some, but as a whole, we're able perhaps to access more people through a virtual world in terms of training. This week alone, our center trained about 3,000 people all over the country. So that may be a reform that stays in the child protection community long term as well.
You know, earlier we were talking about warning signs and things like that. And, you know, for some of us, sometimes we don't feel the urgency of an issue until we see something and it feels too late. And I confess, in my personal network, wasn't someone I know directly, but someone that a friend of mine knows did have a tragedy in their family. And it's, I don't necessarily want to speak to what it was right now, but I just, you know, I don't know if anyone else has seen in the news, but there are gross abuses that are happening during the pandemic. There's a lot of stress, as you spoke to, Victor. I now feel the urgency as well, having seen what happened to that friend of my friend's and her children. And I'm just wondering, you know, we don't want to be cavalier about accusing people of abuse and being quick to, you know, to point fingers, and because it can be very life-altering to accuse people of abuse. But all that said, we also don't want to be too late. So, Victor, can you give us any sort of wisdom or counsel for the adults and listeners listening to this, that, you know, as a community, we're all sort of needing to look out for one another during this time? We're all under a lot of stress. Many people have lost jobs. People are probably, the anxiety of everything is pushing them to a mental strain that they hadn't experienced before. Can you give us any sort of wisdom about what we should be watching for in people? And again, not to be cavalier in conclusions that we make, but what can you share with us?
Sure. You're absolutely right. Everybody's under stress. And so we can think of that in general terms and be widely sharing information that can help moms and dads and other caregivers everywhere manage their own stress and the stress of children. And so in that general sense, we're an agent of preventing abuse at a wide scale. And then in a smaller scale, who do you know in your network who's having a particularly hard time? Who has lost a job? Who is struggling to pay their mortgage? Who may be a single parent with a number of children, and they're indicating on social media or in conversations with you or others that they're really having a hard time? Who may be indicating that they're drinking more or engaging in self-destructive behaviors? All of those are risk signs for maltreatment and warrant an intervention. And it doesn't, you know, necessarily mean police or CPS are getting involved, but you as a caring person are getting involved and saying, hey, what do you need right now to alleviate the stress? What can I do to help you? If need be, calling a Children's Advocacy Center or a social service agency and say, are there additional resources that I can give to my friends who are struggling these days? There are a number of resources out there in every community that we can find to help those who are truly struggling. I would also add, we can model how do we manage stress. So simply acknowledging ourselves in social media or in conversations with friends that this is hard. Parenting is always hard, but it's doubly hard during the pandemic, and that we're having some challenges, and share with others what we're doing to manage our own stress or the stresses of our children. Then it's more palatable because you're less accusatory. You're saying you have struggles too, and here's what you're doing. And that may be an invitation for others to dialogue with you in a healthy way.
Yeah, those are great recommendations. Thank you. Okay, well, thank you for giving us so much to think about and watch for, and to, you know, just learn how to adapt in these other ways. Is there anything that we've missed, Victor, that you'd like to call out? I mean, like I said, we'll direct people to the 25 tips in the report that was put out. Again, that's responding to child abuse during a pandemic. 25 tips for multidisciplinary teams. But Victor, again, is there anything that we've missed here in our conversation that would be important to share before we wrap up?
I think for the child protection professionals that are out there that are responding to child maltreatment, it's really important to take care of ourselves as well. The old adage, when you're on the airplane, you put your own mask on before you help others around you, applies at all times, but especially here in a pandemic. So if your multidisciplinary team has a vicarious trauma plan, I think it's good to revisit that and make adjustments for a pandemic era. And if you don't have such a plan, now's a good time to develop one. Here's a couple of simple things you might consider. A buddy system. So dividing your multidisciplinary teams into teams of two and assigning responsibilities to look out for one another. Everybody develops their own self-care plan. What do you do to manage stress? What do you do to cope with difficult feelings? And then share that with another colleague. And that colleague's job is to check in with you periodically and make sure you're following your own advice, your own self-care plan. And somebody also has your back and is checking in on you. That could be a really helpful approach. For employers out there, I think it's important to find some time in the work week where your employees can get together online in a virtual world and talk about anything other than child abuse, anything other than work. So often in the child protection field, we rely on our colleagues at work because they're the ones who really understand what it is that we're going through. And now we are cut off from them during the quarantine era. So finding some time where during company hours, you can still dialogue about things other than child maltreatment, that can make you a more effective employee simply because you're doing a better job of taking care of yourselves and drawing strength from your colleagues.
Excellent point to be reflective of self-care as well. So important for all of us during this time, but yes, especially for those that are exposed to vicarious trauma. And that certainly includes our child protective services and social workers. So thank you, Victor. And again, just one more time, we would point you toward the report, Responding to Child Abuse During a Pandemic, 25 Tips for Multidisciplinary Teams. And wish all of you luck as you try to navigate the new normal and trying to protect children during the pandemic. We applaud the efforts. Let me just say that before we wrap up. So thank you to those who are continuing to try and care for those who sometimes can't care for themselves. That's so appreciated and needed. So thank you, Victor, again.
Thank you, Emily.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.